Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for your kindness to talk to us. Thank you for recording history of your actions that we can see and we can just rejoice in your providential care for your kids. Lord, I pray this morning you'd help me to explain your word well and properly. I pray each of us would have open hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. So the book of Esther, let me start out, let me quote from Psalm 135, 5 and 6. The psalmist testifies, "For I know that the Lord, that Yahweh is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does, in heaven and on earth, in the deeps and in the seas." Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. There's sovereign power right there. Job came to the same conclusion in Job 42:2. "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted." That's what's going to be on display in the book of Esther. God's sovereignty, but particularly in his providential care for his people. God, our sovereign creator, has both the right and the power to do what he declares to do. That's a quote from John Piper. Yet, from God's word, we understand that his power is always used in accordance with his good purposes, his plan. When God sovereignly intervenes, directing human affairs so that his good purposes are accomplished on behalf of his people, that's his providence. We see his providence in action when he does that. Throughout biblical history, we find abundant examples of God providentially providing for the needs of his people. And even after unfaithful Israel was exiled from the promised land for their many sins, God remained faithful to his covenant with them, always preserving a remnant so that his promises to them might be filled. And get this, he even did that for those who didn't come back to the promised land. He preserved his people. The history recorded in Esther is a snapshot in time. It's just a small handful of years when God moved providentially to spare his people from annihilation. Though he is never mentioned by name in the entire book, God is never mentioned once in the whole book. God is the guiding force behind all the events recorded in this book. And it's quite obvious if you pay attention. God's providential care is on display for all to see. So who's the author of the book? We don't know. Both Hebrew and Christian ancient sources believe that it was probably Mordecai, one of the main characters that we see here. But we honestly don't know. What is its genre? It's history, but it's told in a fashion that almost reads like a story. And because of that, it's amazing. The author really put it down well. Who are the main characters? And this is an order of appearance. God, although he never appears by name, in order of appearance. Number two, Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes in Greek. Xerxes the first, Ahasuerus. In Hebrew, it's Ahasuerus, just for fun. Esther, and then Mordecai, Marduka, something like that in Hebrew, and then Haman, which in Hebrew I prefer is Haman. He's the only one I'm going to try and say Hebrew because it's easy. What are the purposes? What are the purposes of the book of Esther? To show how God sovereignly protected his people who remain in exile. To encourage Jews to trust in Yahweh's compassionate care no matter where they lived. And to encourage future generations, including us, to remember how God delivered them from destruction. And for the Jews, it was by celebrating Purim, the festival that they still celebrate to this very day. What are the themes? They're really easy. Providence. Providence. Nothing is outside of God's protective care and control. And the other theme that's pretty obvious is reversal. God frequently flips a situation right on his head. So something that might seem the most dire, God can change. And that's important to remember for ourselves. Okay, the structure. You've got it written there. Basically, I divide it in three sections. Providential positioning. God is placing the chess pieces on the board just where he wants them to be. And then God's people are threatened, and then God saves his people. Basically, it's three sections, and the first one really isn't a section. It's just an intro. Okay? So let me give you some historical background that's really important and actually kind of fun. It's not dull like most historical backgrounds I find to be. Let me just walk you through. You know that there were a succession of empires. And if you turn to the second page, you'll see a picture of the Persian Empire. But the Persian Empire wasn't the first. And we're going to back up to the Assyrian Empire. They're the ones that conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, known as Samaria, in 722 BC. And then they deported many Hebrews into Assyrian territories. And to be honest with you, Assyria looked like just a little bit smaller version than what you see here as far as the Persian domination. All of the darkened areas are Persian. So Assyria took over and then kicked out the northern kingdom folks into Assyrian lands. Well, then later the Babylonian Empire, sometimes called the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Why do they call it that? Because the Babylonians rose up more than once. So the second time they rise up, they're still called the Babylonian Empire, but it's really the new one, the Neo-Babylonian. They, led by King Nebuchadnezzar, remember him, defeated the Assyrians in 722, and then he laid siege to Jerusalem and eventually destroyed both its walls and the temple in 586. And most of the Hebrews in that area were then exiled from Judah into Babylonian-controlled territories, and you'll see that in Jeremiah and 2 Kings. Now, Babylon looked an awful lot like Persia, just a little smaller. All right? So really, we're talking about these successive kingdoms. They sort of take over from the other one, and then they grow. And they take over from the other one, and then they grow. That's how that kind of works. Okay, now we come to the time of... Lost my place. Let me find it here. There we go. I need page 287. There it is. Now we come to the Persian Empire. There's a series of kings over the Persian Empire. The first is Cyrus. You've heard his name in the Bible before. He conquered Babylon in 539 BC, and that's when the Persians took over from the Babylonians, right? Some Jews returned basically the next year with Zerubbabel because of the decree in Cyrus in 538 BC, and that's in Ezra, the first two chapters. Then Cyrus' decree in 538, he allowed many to return, but many did not return. Why? When they were exiled, they had kind of planted, and some of them really prospered. And so they didn't want to go back to a city that was broken down, right? And where they were threatened on all sides. So most actually stayed in exile. That's important to remember. Now, Cambyses replaces Cyrus, and it's during his reign that the rebuilding of the temple stops, and that's in Ezra 4, all right? Remember when the threats came and it just stopped. They gave up. Then Darius, it was under his reign, he replaced Cambyses, that Ezra 5 and 6 shows us that the temple was completed. So these are the guys that are in order. And then we come to the time of Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes. And this is the time of Esther. Ahasuerus, well, we'll come back to him in a second, then drop down to Artaxerxes the First. More Hebrews return with Ezra in 456 during the time of Artaxerxes, and that's Ezra 7 and 8, and Nehemiah in 445 BC. So in between Darius and Artaxerxes, in between part of Ezra and a little bit of Ezra and Nehemiah is Esther, the time frame. Okay? So you kind of locate that? Got that in your head? Now, Ahasuerus is really interesting because he invades Greece in 480 BC. And then he takes Athens, way on the left side of the page here, way over here. He takes Athens and holds it for a short period of time, and eventually the Greeks kick him out, and then he returns. And it's funny because that war and him being kicked out and returning happened during the book of Esther, and the events fall during that, and you'll see how some of these things relate. All right, so let's talk about providential positioning. God is arranging the chess pieces, page 288. Here's the setting. And by the way, I've counted 7 feasts. Some people say there are 6. I could even see as many as 8 if you count one that's doubled. And the book seems to be structured, some people say the book is structured around the feast. I tried, I failed, so I'm just going to point out where they are, just for fun, because it's almost another theme, feasting. The setting. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. So you look at that map, all the way to the right is the Indus Valley, India, all the way to the left, or all the way down here, Ethiopia begins in this area, Sudan's in here, and actually, I think this map probably undersells how much territory he had in Africa. So this guy controlled, it was basically the biggest empire on earth that was known at that time. I should have printed this out on single pages so I can keep up with myself here. Let's see, 286, 287, 280. I don't do books well. All right. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel. By the way, there were four capitals. Susa, you'll find on the maps, kind of middle right. I think we'd call that modern-day Iran. It was one of his winter capitals. It was warmer there in the winter. So he's in his winter capital, sitting on his throne. In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media, by the way, sometimes it's called Medo-Persia. Why? Because the Persians kind of subsumed the Medes, which were to the north, and so it was called the Medo-Persian Empire. So the army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him. So imagine this gigantic army, all these nobles are there. Why? He's about to go to war with Greece, and he needs the support of his people. Okay? While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So the book of Esther begins by recording one of seven. It says six, seven. I found another one. Seven feasts mentioned in the book. Ahasuerus shares this, or throws this first feast to celebrate himself. I'm great, and you should support me, because I'm fixing to go to war with the Greeks. History records that just before this time, he successfully subdued an Egyptian rebellion down south, so he was feeling his oats, he was successful, and shortly after this time, he would lead the Persian army in a short-lived invasion of Greece. This might explain why the army is present, as well as all his chief officials, why he needs support from everybody. B, Vashti is deposed as queen, the next section. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, so he's feeling really good because he's tipsy, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with a royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty. So eunuchs, men that were castrated, were usually appointed to care for the harem or the concubines or the wives. Those are three different categories. Harem is usually a women who are not yet concubines. Concubines, they've been with the king. Wives are the queen, right? And so these men who presumably are safer are appointed to care for the women, right? So he calls them before him and he says, bring the queen. Why? She's good looking. I want to show her off, right? That's what's going on here. But Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this time, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. So under the influence of too much wine, Ahasuerus' pride causes him to attempt to put his queen's physical beauty on display before everybody. And you can imagine if you were her, she refuses, right? And his pride turns to rage. The difficulty is a Persian monarch you didn't refuse for anything. There were things that would cost you. You'll see that even showing up in his presence unannounced could cost you your life. So, it's pretty unusual. She refuses, his pride turns to rage, and he turns to his quote-unquote wise men, who are also called the seven princes of Media, for their opinion about how to deal with the situation. So a fella named Memucan speaks for all of them in verse 16. He says, not only against the king has the queen Vashti done wrong, but against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Basically, she's insulted the whole world. That's what he's saying. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. Right? This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. So what is he saying? He's saying that, well, she's done this, and so now basically all of our wives are going to rebel. Is that true? It's kind of silly. Memucan is afraid that Vashti's refusal will lead to rebellion among the women of the empire, so he proposes that the king issued a royal order that, verse 19, listen to this, may not be repealed. And that's the rule of a Persian monarch's edict. Once it goes out, can't be revoked. Period. Even if it's wrong, even if it's bad, cannot be revoked. Think about that. It may not be repealed that Vashti is never again to come before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who's better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all the kingdom, for it's vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. All right. So Ahasuerus and the others agree that this is a great course of action, and the king's edict is written and sent to every corner of the empire. It's translated into every language in every corner of the empire. And now there's no queen in Persia. No queen at all. God is working through the prideful decisions of men to do what? To establish a new queen on the throne of his choosing, right? Why? Because he needs her there to protect his people. That's part of his plan. So there's a search for a new queen that begins. Look at 2:1-11. After Ahasuerus' anger abated, he remembered that he deposed Vashti as queen, and apparently his courtiers recognized some unhappiness in him. It doesn't exactly say what his emotional state is, but they suggest that he should let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. So this royal search for a new queen and the year-long preparations to follow would have taken place while Ahasuerus was away leading his army against Greece. Think about that. So he's invading Greece, and his forces would conquer Athens for a time, but Greeks would eventually turn the tables and drive the Persian army away, and he'd come back. Now the story changes, and it now focuses on a new character. In fact, it focuses on two, Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin, and that's really important. It says so. And he descended from those who Nebuchadnezzar had driven into exile a century before. All right? He is a father to his much younger cousin, Esther. So he's adopted her as his daughter. So he's much older than she is. Why? Because she's lost both of her parents. Because Esther is especially beautiful. Now think about this. They're doing a search for all the beauties. I mean, they're after the mega beauties, right? You know, I don't know what you know, whatever. Because if you brought every good-looking woman in the kingdom, there wouldn't be room in Susa, right? But so they're actually looking for ones that, for some reason, stand out in their minds. And she is one of those people. She's especially beautiful, and she's also required. And she is required by law now to relocate to the winter capital of Susa and is enrolled in the king's harem under the charge of Haggai, one of the king's trusted eunuchs, who soon elevates her position among the virgins. And here you start to see God's providence at work. And the young women pleased him, and the young woman, that is Esther, pleased him, pleased Haggai, and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food and with 7 young women for the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. So again, God's providential hand is granting favor to Esther, one of his chosen people, even though the authorities don't know that she's a Hebrew. Why? Mordecai had made her promise not to tell anybody. Think about that. He'd ordered her not to tell anybody. So, turn the page, 290, Esther becomes queen in chapter 2:12-18. And there's a second feast. So, after this group of young virgins was selected, they essentially lived in spa-like conditions for over a year, undergoing beauty treatments to enhance their attractiveness to the king. Talks about myrrh and special oils and spices and stuff like that, you know. Maybe it's like a whole Mary Kay seminar for a year. I have no idea. So, verse 12 says, now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was a regular period of beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments. So they probably smelled really good, right? So Ahasuerus had returned from his unsuccessful invasion of Greece. The preparations of the virgins were completed. The selection process begins. And each would spend an evening with the king, which would mean they would transfer from the harem to the concubines after that. And the king would choose the one he liked the best. And even here, we see the hand of God on Esther's behalf. Verse 15. Now, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all of the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti, right? Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. Here's another one. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the province, so everybody can celebrate, right? Tax break. And gave gifts with royal generosity. So everybody in the Persian Empire, everybody, has a reason to celebrate Queen Vashti. Not the least of which was the poor folks that just had their taxes. Pardon me?
Queen Esther.
Sorry about that. Thank you. I do that a lot. That's why I have a wife. She helps me. So everyone in the Persian Empire had something to celebrate. But something more significant had happened than the crowning of a new queen. God providentially guided the desires, even the lusts, of a pagan king to put his woman in the position where she might save her people, even before they were in danger. Think about that. They're not even in danger yet. God's working. So, Mordecai saves the king's life. God's plan included more than the elevation of Esther to the throne. Mordecai also has a pivotal role to play. So, the text focuses on Mordecai and how God orchestrated something that would lead to his advancement too. Verse 21. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai, right? Okay, so, by the way, when Mordecai is described as sitting at the king's gate, it probably means he's a minor official. The likelihood is quite high that that's what that means. And here, through the providence of God, Mordecai was in the right place at just the right time to overhear a plot against the king and report it to Esther. So a legal investigation is opened, the plotters were found guilty, and they're hanged, and the whole affair was inscribed in the official records, which is important. That last fact is going to play a real big role in the salvation of God's people a few chapters later. So now we come to the second part of my outline. God's people are threatened. And we see the rise of Haman, right? By the way, if you were a Jew, every time I said that word, and it was Purim, what would you do? You'd have a noisemaker, and you'd try and drown out his name. It's a lot of fun. It's a good time. So you ready? The rise of Haman. All right, good. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, and that's really important, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Haman is called an Agagite, a descendant of Agag, the Amalekite king. Now, in Moses' day, the Amalekites unprovoked attacked Israel before they entered the Promised Land. And after that battle, Yahweh told Moses to record his promise to, quote, utterly blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. God promises to wipe out the Amalekites, right? Okay. Hundreds of years later, God commanded King Saul, a Benjaminite like Mordecai, to do what? And the people of Israel to wipe out the Amalekites for the earlier treachery. Saul disobeyed, and what did he do? He spared Agag, and he took some of the plunder. What is this bleeding of sheep that I hear? Remember the prophet saying that to him? And that ultimately cost Saul his throne. And Samuel, the prophet, then obeyed God by, quote-unquote, hacking Agag to pieces before the Lord, 1 Samuel 15:33, which gives a strong impression of how much of an offense the Amalekites were in God's eyes, right? Hacked him to pieces in front of the people, right? Okay. The fact that Haman is labeled an Agagite lends an ominous note to this story. You know, dun-dun-dun. You should hear like the march that Darth Vader does when Haman comes onto scene, right? You know, dun 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 dun, right? Why? It confirms that he's surely an enemy of God's people, and the term enemy of God's people is used multiple times, referring to Haman. So Mordecai defies Haman in chapter 3, verse 3. Sadly, Haman's elevation led to an untenable situation for Mordecai. Why? Because the king's order compelled all of his servants. And remember, since he sat at the gate, very likely he's one of them. Compelled all of his servants to bow down and pay homage to Haman, to prostrate themselves before Haman in submission, which Mordecai could not do because verse 4 of chapter 3 said he was a Jew. He knows the score. He knows the history. And when Haman saw that Mordecai didn't bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. Haman's fury then moved him to seek the destruction of Mordecai's people. I mean, he doesn't focus on Mordecai. He focuses on the whole race of Jews. Verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. It's not enough to just take care of Mordecai. So as they made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now think about this. You know, Esther is a very small piece of the Old Testament, right? But the ramifications of what we just read are huge. Think about it. If Haman's evil desires come to fruition, it would amount to essentially a total extermination of the Jewish race. Because virtually every Jew is going to live within this empire. It also includes Israel, by the way. And it includes Egypt. It includes, got it? So this would result in the destruction of God's people. No wonder the book of Esther refers to Haman three times as the enemy of the Jews. Clearly, a battle is brewing. You can see it. And the way the writer Esther has introduced both Mordecai the Benjamite and Haman the Agagite sets up a rematch of the fight between Saul and Agag in 1 Samuel 15. So this is like history repeating itself, right? Okay, turn the page. Haman's plot to kill the Jews. Verse 7, more than 4 years have passed now since Esther was crowned queen. More than 4 years. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, they cast lots. It was a way of seeking divine will about something. It's almost like rolling dice. All right, so they cast lots. In other words, Haman and his little cadre there are essentially rolling dice day after day before Haman, day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. What are they looking for? They're looking for the time when they're going to spring their evil plan. And during this time, Haman has cooked up a plan to exterminate the Jews. And here we find him casting lots to determine the month. But Proverbs 7:33 reminds us that the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord, right? So what are they doing? They're doing something which the Lord is in complete control of, right? So, indeed, the month designated by chance in their eyes, but by Yahweh in reality, would give God's people nearly a year to prepare for the danger that's coming. Isn't that something? They could have worked that plan right away, but instead they wait almost a year. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from everyone, from those of every other people, and they don't keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, and the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you, right? So Mordecai offers to enrich the king's treasury with a fantastic sum of money, which presumably he's going to get from the spoils of the Hebrew people, right? I mean, it is an absolutely fantastic amount. By the way, this may give an indication that God had really prospered the Hebrew people, that he thought that kind of money was available from their plunder. As we observed earlier, an edict given by the king, guaranteed by the imprint of his signet. Signet, you know, sometimes we think of it as rings. Signet can also be like a clay tube with a particular picture or pattern on it that then you roll across like wax or a clay and then allow it to bake or harden. So in whatever form it took, a signet is sort of like the king's signature. It's something that's not reproduced by anybody else. And the fact that Haman had the signet or was allowed to use it is really, it gives you an idea of how high Haman's power is in the kingdom. He's number two, right? Okay. Haman worded this document in such a way that it seemed hopeless for the Hebrews, and it was sent, quote, to every province in its own script and to every people in its own language, and sealed with the king's signet ring. Apparently it's a ring, right? Okay. And it included an instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day. Totally annihilate the Hebrew race. One day. the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So what happens? Mordecai cries out to God. So when the news of the king's decree reached the ears of Mordecai, he began to cry out to the Lord. Now, again, the Lord is never mentioned, but the actions make it clear what he's doing. Look what it says, verse 1, chapter 4. Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out to the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. The wearing of sackcloth and ashes signifies deep grief and repentance. Towards whom? God. Mordecai also begins to lament. Towards whom? God. It's implicit. That's what a Jew does, right? And he wasn't alone in his grief, because verse 3 says, in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. These are all things that biblically occur when people are crying out to God for help, right? So God is unseen, but he's clearly here, right? And many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther learned of Mordecai's grief, she was, quote, deeply distressed, or as the LSB translates it, and this is better, the queen writhed in deep anguish. Think about that. She's broken, right? She's very much hurting for her people. So she sent the eunuch Hathach to find out why. I wish these guys had easier names to say. So Mordecai reminds Esther of God's providence. That's what we see next. Mordecai provided a copy of the decree to Hathach so that he could explain the situation to Esther. And more than that, to call her to plead with the king for the lives of her people. This was a dangerous request. Why? Because anyone who appeared uninvited before the king was sentenced to death unless the king lowered his scepter, which was a sign of acceptance that you could approach and you were welcome. Think about that. So if you showed up unannounced and you didn't lower his scepter, death. Right? See if anybody walks in. I'll get my pen ready to go here. See if I lower it or not when they walk in. Esther had not been invited to appear before Ahasuerus for the last 30 days. Think about that. But Mordecai understood that God's providence was at work, so he sent this message back to Esther. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Now think about this. Mordecai is confident in what? That God will bring deliverance no matter what. Right? He's confident. It will rise from another place, Esther, if you don't help. But his message to Esther forces her to consider that she may be the very one through whom God will work to bring that deliverance. Right? Now here's an application for you and I. Right? God's providence is still at work on behalf of his people today in big and small ways. Do you and I see ourselves as instruments to be used by the Lord to bring about his provision, his protection, his deliverance to others? Do we see ourselves that way? God can use anybody. He's obviously even in control of the evil people and their choices. Do we see ourselves as people who are to be used as instruments of God? Because that's what Mordecai is calling Esther to do. Okay, so Esther responds wisely. What does she do? She calls others to fast. Why? In intercession to God on her behalf. Because otherwise they're just going without food, right? That doesn't help anything unless you're appealing to a God who can change things, right? So that God might preserve her life when she approaches the king. And she says, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, in the capital here, and hold a fast on my behalf, and don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Right? So she's ready to serve her people, to go before the king. She's willing to give her life. So during those 3 days, God granted Esther wisdom in how to approach the king on behalf of her people, and she puts her plan into action. So She gives another feast. This is the third one, hosting Ahasuerus and Haman. 5:1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance of the palace. And when the king saw Esther, so she's in his visual range, right? Which is illegal. She hasn't been invited. When the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, right? And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your quest? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom." So God answers the request of his people, all those folks that were praying and fasting. God answers, and Esther was granted such extraordinary favor that the king responds with an oath that promises to give her whatever she asks for. When he says, "up to half of my kingdom," it means whatever you ask, I'm going to give, right? By the way, who also made that same promise in the New Testament? Herod. That's why John lost his head, right? Okay. So she asked that both he and Haman attend a feast in their honor. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Look at this. I mean, just favor after favor being granted to her through King Ahasuerus. The king enjoyed the feast. He makes the same promise again. Esther may have whatever she wishes from his hand. So this lady's really wise. She requests that both the king and Haman attend yet another feast the next day. And Haman responds with great joy. And on the way out, God providentially arranges, I love this, for him to see Mordecai on his way out, which inflames his hatred for Mordecai and the Jews. And Haman returns home. But he gloats to his wife and friends that he alone was invited to feast with the king and the queen. He also recounts, quote, "the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king." So he's number two, right? And he's just so proud of it. And so what happens? His wife and all of his friends that are there, they all interpret these blessings as divine favor upon Haman, right? And so they suggest that he deal with Mordecai right away. Don't waste any time. Let's get rid of this guy, right? So verse 14, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made. And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So think about this. Unbeknownst to Haman, he was constructing the instrument of his own death. He's going to die on this gallows. God's going to reverse the situation, right? God would soon go to battle for his people in fulfillment of Exodus 17:16. God said he would forever war against Amalek. And God is going to fight against this descendant of Amalek in this story. So the next section is God saves his people. What happens? Mordecai is rewarded. So once more, divine providence works in ordinary ways. Ordinary ways. The king has insomnia. Poor guy can't sleep. You know, the melatonin isn't working. There's no-dos. And so, perhaps in an effort to fall back to sleep, he orders an attendant to read to him from the recorded history books kept in the official archives. I wonder if it's because they're considered boring. I don't know. It's like reading the telephone book directory or something. Yeah, we don't have telephone books anymore. But apparently this one's pretty interesting because what is read is helpful to the cause of God's people. Verse 2, chapter 6. It was found written. And by the way, look at this. The very part of the history that they pick involves Mordecai. I mean, just God just arranged and everything, right? And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So this record comes as a complete surprise to King Ahasuerus. He recognizes that Mordecai deserves a reward for saving his life, so he calls for the nearest of those from whom he can seek wise counsel about how to reward this good deed. Where is he going to find them? In his court, right? He's in his bed. But so what does he do? The king said, who's in the court? You know, what one of my wise guys is out there so I can consult them about how to bless Mordecai. Now Mordecai had just entered the outer court of the king to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he'd prepared for him. I love it. Nobody else is there, but Mordecai just walks in with Haman. Sorry, man. I get this wrong all the time. Haman strolls in thinking that he's going to end Mordecai, but the king is going to ask him how to bless Mordecai. Reversal, right? Reversal. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So divine providence intercedes. Haman just happens to appear in the court just when no one else is around. He intends evil toward Mordecai, but God intends the opposite. Haman's own evil will reverse and is going to fall on his own head. So once Haman is called in, the king's asked him, now imagine you're Haman. King has just been advancing you. You're number two. Blessed, blessed. You just had a meal by yourself with the king and the queen, right? And now you're invited to another one. So it's all about you, right? And the king asks him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? So immediately, who's he thinking the king's talking about? Why, me, of course. You know, he didn't say it, right? But he's thinking it. And Haman, assuming the king is referring to him, answers with an honor so great as to be fit for a conquering king. And look, the honor that he suggests be done essentially puts that honored person in the position of the king, looking like a king, riding like a king. I'm not kidding. Look what he says. And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. So he he's thinking, hey, dress me up like you, right? Let me ride one of your horses. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. In other words, whoever's number three, give it to that guy. And let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor in public. This is all to be done publicly. And let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Boy, he's buttering it up, right? I want all this, man. This is what I want. I really want to be king, you know. That's what it seems like. Haman is so sure that he's the one to be honored. But God providentially reverses the situation to bless Mordecai. And I wish I could have been there to see the look on his face when this happened. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you've mentioned. I love it. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai, again, at the king's gate, in public, right? And led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. I'm sure he just felt real great about that. So the very thing Haman intended for his own glory becomes a means to humble him publicly before Mordecai. And just as Haman's wife and friends read his former blessing as God's favor, they now read this humiliation as a sign of Haman's doom. So now we see the fall of Haman. It just starts here in verse 12. So Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Why? What does he prize most? Himself. And he's been publicly humiliated, right? And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Because if he's a Jew, you're doomed. That's what they're saying. Notice how even his wife seems to understand that God will fight against Haman for seeking the demise of a Jew. So she also rightly concludes that Haman's fall has already begun and will continue. And Haman doesn't even have a moment to think about it, about this coming doom. Why? The king's eunuchs arrive And they hurry to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Haman is a dead man walking. Literally. Why? Because God is against him. Because God is against him. So now we see Haman's last meal. This is feast number 4. Esther wines and dines Haman and Ahasuerus yet again. And the king responds with the same grand promise to grant whatever she wishes. Again, God's favor on display, right? The queen Esther answered, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted to me for my wish and my people for my request." Does he know her life's in danger? No. Why? He doesn't know she's of that certain people to whom Haman had the decree made that they be destroyed, right? She has not revealed her heritage to Ahasuerus. But now she does. Verse 4, "For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Three words that say almost the same thing. We're going to be wiped out, right? Just imagine how emphatic that is, the way she said it, three different ways. "If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Esther is saying that she wouldn't even trouble the king if her people had simply been sold into slavery. But since their very existence and her own is threatened, she must bring it to his attention. And the king responds by asking, "Who has dared to do this?" He's kind of clueless, isn't he? "Who has dared to do this?" He hadn't put two and two together. And Esther finally unmasks the treachery of Haman by calling him out as a foe, an enemy. I bet she's pointing right at him, right? A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman. And again, what are they? They're at a feast together, right? So presumably they're sitting fairly close, probably reclining on couches, right? Haman immediately fears for his life. Yeah, the queen's pointing you out, right? To the king. And the king, full of wrath, heads to the palace garden to wrap his mind around what he just heard. I think it's interesting. How often do we guys, you know, when we're kind of overwhelmed with something, it's like we got to go for a walk and, you know, get our mind around it. But again, this is providential, because what happens? Seeing this last opportunity to save his skin, Haman begins to beg for his life from Queen Esther. And once again, divine providence moves against Haman, because the moment the king returns, the very moment he returns, he finds Haman in the process of accidentally falling down or intentionally prostrating himself. I can't tell based on the Hebrew. So he's either accidentally falling down or intentionally prostrating himself before the queen on the couch on which she was reclining to eat the meal. And Ahasuerus interprets this, when he sees it, as an assault on his wife. Again, perfect timing, right? Perfect timing. God's providence. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high." Cubits, generally, there's multiple cubits, but the longest one's 21 inches. Most of them are about 18. So 50 cubits would be 75 feet high. Tall gallows, right? Wonder how long the rope was. And the king said, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he'd prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. So Haman's plans to kill Mordecai reversed upon him, didn't it? The same night he swung upon the very gallows he built for Mordecai, God providentially protected Mordecai, and this reversal now continues because Mordecai takes Haman's place. Look at verse 1 of chapter 8. "On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews." Again, three times it's spoken this way about Haman, in case you didn't know, he's bad. "And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her." And the king, in other words, she said, this is actually my adopted dad. He's my older cousin, but he adopted me. He's been taking care of me since my parents passed away. And the king took off his signet ring, which he'd taken from Haman. So Haman apparently was the regular carrier of the signet, right? Number 2. And he gives it to Mordecai, which makes Mordecai what? number two in the kingdom, right? And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the reversal is nearly complete now. Mordecai has supplanted Haman as second in command over all the Persian Empire. He now possesses everything that formerly belonged to Haman, his enemy. There's only one more reversal that's needed, and what is that? The people need to be saved, right? There's still this edict that cannot be revoked, that they're going to be annihilated on this particular day coming up, right? And a Persian edict can't be rescinded. How will God's people survive? Well, God will provide a new edict. Look at verse 4, chapter 8. Esther risks her life again and comes to the king uninvited. And falling down before him, she begs him to save her people from Haman's evil plan. He lowers his scepter to receive her, right? And she begs him to revoke the dreadful edict. Yet, a Persian edict with the seal of his signet may not be revoked. So, he gives her permission to write another irrevocable decree that might counteract the effects of the first. So you've got to word this right, right? It's like what happens in Congress, you know, you got to make sure you get the wording just right. No loopholes, right? And somehow it's got to completely annul the other one. It's got to completely reverse the effects. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "You may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked." The king's scribes were summoned at that time, and an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews. So who's God working through? Mordecai. Wisdom that God has given him to craft this edict in such a way that his people will be saved. Like the first, this edict was sent out to every corner of the empire in every language. And here's what it authorized the Jews to do, to take protective action. This new edict, 8:11, allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate, the very same words that were used against them, any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. On one day, throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So look, there's two edicts out there, and they both happen on the same day. Both come due the same day. John MacArthur points out that 2 months and 10 days after Haman's evil decree became the law of the land, and again, it became the law of the land, but the date of its enforcement was in the future, this new edict is now issued. Both would take effect simultaneously, and the Hebrew people, because of this, would have 8 months and 20 days to get ready. Lots of time, right? So they're going to the gun store, you know. I'll take that AK. Can I have the blue dot, the red dot sight, you know? They're preparing to defend themselves, right?
Got a question?
Yeah.
So is that first edict still?
Yes. It's still in effect.
Even though there's a second.
Both of them are in effect. So everybody has the right, if they choose to try and annihilate the Jews. And on that same day, the Jews have the right to defend themselves and annihilate and plunder all who try and annihilate them. So it's set up. But the Jews have all this time to prepare, right? Okay. Verse 15, chapter 8. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. He looks like a king himself, doesn't he? The Jews had a light and glad had light and gladness and joy and honor in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached. There was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. Oh, look, another feast. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. I'm a Jew. No. Shalom, brother. Right? Next, we see the enemies defeated, chapter 9, 1 through 6. The fateful day arrives. Both edicts come into force. One allows the enemies of the Jews to attack. Another allows the Jews to go to war against their attackers. And God providentially moves on behalf of his people. And their enemies are filled with what? Debilitating dread. This starts to sound like, you know, Moses, Joshua kind of stuff, right? The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who had sought their harm, and no one could stand against them. Why? For the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. God's providence, right? And because Mordecai had been publicly elevated to Ahasuerus' right hand, God causes the governing authorities to aid his people. 9:3. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. He's number two. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. Again, providence of God all over this, right? And just like the people of Israel saw God's hand give them victory in the days of Moses and Joshua, God gave them success against their enemies throughout the empire. Verse 5, the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. And in Susa, now this is just speaking about the capital here. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And also killed Parshandatha, and Dalphon, and Espatha, and Paratha, and Adalia, and Aradatha, and Parmashta, and Arasai, and Ardai, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, glad that's over, the enemy of the Jews. So they wiped out the posterity of Haman, which is exactly what God decreed. He was going to go to war against Amalek perpetually. But listen to this last phrase. They laid no hand on the plunder. What does that make you think of? Saul. Doesn't kill Agag. Plunders. What's the bleating of sheep that I hear? Right? Oh. So this first battle is a total success. Yet, we can see later that some potentially influential enemies remain in the capital city. So God prompted Ahasuerus to offer yet another boon to Esther. Verse 12, now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa, so just in this city, be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. By the way, they're already dead. God's people were given yet another opportunity to destroy their enemies. And so they did. And the already dead sons of Haman were publicly strung up, serving as a warning of God's vengeance upon Israel's enemies. Yet no Hebrew took anything that belonged to their adversaries. This completes the reversal. Mordecai, the son of Benjamin, fulfilled God's decree to wipe out the Amalekites, which Saul failed to do. And unlike Saul, who disobeyed God by taking plunder from the Amalekites he conquered, none in Israel were willing to take spoils from those who hated them, for, quote, they laid no hands on the plunder. It's a complete reversal. God sovereignly intervened on behalf of his covenant people. His providential care has so orchestrated men and women, both good and evil, and events both good and bad, so that certain doom for his people became sure blessing, right? And his people were grateful. And now we see that they celebrate this salvation. Chapter 9. Here's the seventh feast. And actually, you might even say an eighth, because they celebrate the same feast on two different days, depending on whether they're in Susa or they're outside of the capital. On the 14th day, they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th and rested on the 15th, making that a day of feasting and gladness. So technically, you could call it an even eighth feast there. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness. Now remember, how was that month chosen? By casting of lots, right? By casting of pur. That they should make them days of feasting. As the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned from them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, and that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another, gifts to the poor. So here we have the origins of the Hebrew festival of Purim. Verse 23. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and destroy them. When you hear im, like a singular angel, sometimes is called a cherub. Multiple cherubs are cherubim. The im ending is plural. So pur, purim, plural. Casting of lots, right? Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the term Pur. The Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written in the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. And Esther ends with just a hint of God's ongoing provision for his people through Mordecai. Chapter 10, verse 1, King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king had advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to his people. So, what do we take away? What's our conclusion? Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. God says, remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purposes. Think about this. Had God not intervened in history as recorded in the book of Esther, every promise made to Moses, Abraham, and David would have been annulled, for his people would be no more. The Messiah would never be born to a Jewish virgin in Bethlehem. The gospel of salvation through Christ would never be proclaimed to a sin-sick world. To say that the events described in Esther have far-reaching implications is the greatest understatement I can think of. If Esther didn't happen, we're not saved. Thankfully, God did orchestrate the events in Esther. He was and is truly in control of human history and every moment that makes it up. And he is bringing everything to his intended conclusion for the sake of his glory and for the good of his covenant people, both new and old. God actively oversees and guides the course of human history through the good times and the bad. And although God is never mentioned directly in the book of Esther, every chapter reveals his work through various means, both large and small, in the lives of great and obscure, to fulfill his covenant promise, his covenant commitment to his people. The book of Esther demonstrates the effective providential care God pours out on his people even in the face of overwhelming odds. We can trust God to keep his promises to us too, right? And we can trust his providential care that will eventually bring us home to glory no matter what, no matter what, no matter who, right? The book of Esther also encourages God's people to cry out to him in faith during times of trial, knowing that God has the power to reverse any situation, no matter how bleak, and to act in accordance with his will in the knowledge that one single person, like Mordecai, or like Esther, providentially guided by God, can make an enormous difference for countless numbers of others. Nothing is beyond God's control. He is willing and able to cause everything to work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose, right? Romans 8:28. And finally, the book of Esther also helps the reader to understand the origins of Purim, the reason it should be remembered, and the significance it has to the Hebrew people. That's it. All right. Dave, will you pray us out here, sir?